My name is Anthony Freud. I'm the General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and today I'm speaking to you about Richard Strauss's fourth opera, Elektra. The horrors of World War I so shocked the generation that survived it that the years before became, in retrospect, a time of innocence. Poet Philip Larkin, in his poem describing earnest young men who stood in line to join the British Army, wrote, "Never such innocence again." William Butler Yeats described the post-war breakdown of society in apocalyptic terms, in which the ceremony of innocence is drowned. People forget that the title of Edith Wharton's 12th novel, The Age of Innocence, had an element of irony to it. Certainly one can appreciate why the war generation would have felt this way. But memory, even memory not affected by such cataclysmic events, can be a tricky thing. Were the years around the turn of the 20th century really so innocent? Put aside for a moment the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, the appearance of Jack the Ripper in London in the 1880s, the sensational 1893 trial of Lizzie Borden for axe murdering her parents, the Boxer Rebellion in 1899, and the Russian Revolution of 1905. That was merely reality. In literature, the romanticism of the early 19th century had given place to gothic horror and penny dreadfuls. Edgar Allan Poe, E.T.A. Hoffmann, and Mary Shelley were no longer shocking enough. Now people were gulping down the Sherlock Holmes stories of Arthur Conan Doyle, The Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells, The Prisoner of Zenda by Anthony Hope, and Dracula by Bram Stoker. Violence was in. Lurid, graphic violence in the name of entertainment. And Elektra is violent, both its story and its music. The musical excerpts are from an EMI Classics recording featuring Eva Marton as Elektra, Cheryl Studer as Chrysotomis, Mariana Lipovcek as Clytemnestra, and Bernd Weichel as Orestes. Wolfgang Sawallisch conducts the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra. Special thanks to EMI for allowing us to use their recording and to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. "Wo bleibt Elektra?" begins the opera. Where's Elektra? The five housemaids want to know. In the libretto written by Austrian poet Hugo von Hofmannsthal, this is not merely a literal question. Elektra is described in animal terms. She's poisonous, a snake perhaps, or a wild spitting cat. Or maybe she's a large dog, the form first taken by Dracula in Bram Stoker's novel. She glares at passers-by and groans. "Away foul flies," Elektra screams. "Away horse flies. Don't feed on my sores." These are carrion flies, feeding on rotting flesh. It's as if she has already come to a violent end. Elektra is not just an animal, but a dead one. Real violence has already occurred offstage. Hofmannsthal based his opera on a play he himself had written 5 years earlier in 1904. In Greek mythology, Elektra is the daughter of King Agamemnon and Queen Clytemnestra. Her uncle is King Menelaus of Sparta, the husband of Helen of Troy, the world's most beautiful woman, who has abandoned Menelaus for the Trojan prince Paris. Menelaus is outraged and insulted, so he and his brother, King Agamemnon of Mycenae, lead a pan-Greek force to Troy to get her back. Hence the sobriquet that Helen had a face that launched 1,000 ships. The resulting Trojan War lasts 10 years and ruins the lives of almost everyone involved. Troy is sacked, and all the Trojan princes except Aeneas are killed. The Greek hero Achilles first loses his best friend or lover Patroclus, then kills the Trojan prince Hector in revenge. and is ultimately killed himself thanks to an arrow in his unprotected Achilles' heel. The Greek general Odysseus spends 10 years trying to get home, hence the Odyssey. Menelaus returns to Greece with Helen, but the relationship is a bit strained. And Agamemnon? Well, Agamemnon returns home to find that his wife Clytemnestra has been sleeping with, and worse, reigning with, his cousin Aegisthus, the incestuous son of... Well, never mind. There's a bloody story there too, with cooked children being served for dinner. But I digress. After 10 years of sleeping in a tent, Agamemnon just wants a bath. But when he takes one, he's attacked. A blanket is thrown over him, and he's stabbed to death. The murderer is either Clytemnestra or her lover Aegisthus, depending on whom you ask. Electra is frothing at the mouth because of this last murder. Agamemnon is her father, and when the opera opens, her murdering mother and lover are ruling in his place. The one person who might be able to do something about all this, Electra's brother Orestes, has been banished. So Electra is testy and glares at passers-by. It's not hard to see why Hofmannsthal was drawn to the story. The Romantic 19th century was obsessed with the Greeks as the fountain of culture and art. Fin de siècle Vienna was obsessed with obsession. Sigmund Freud was a neighbor of Hofmannsthal's in Vienna. And the Greek dramatists provided the archetype. Thespis, the quasi-mythical Greek founder of tragedy, was followed by three quite real Greek playwrights whose dramas survive and who were the foundation for European theatre. Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides all wrote plays featuring Electra and her cursed family. Hofmannsthal based his Electra on the Sophocles version. Electra's personal tragedy was old news, but the opera was the first of many collaborations between Richard Strauss and Hofmannsthal. It would set several precedents. Greek mythology would form the basis for their third and fifth collaborations, Ariadne auf Naxos and the Egyptian Helen. The romance with the past that drew Hofmannsthal to those myths would saturate their opera, Der Rosenkavalier. And the poet's own obsession with myth would colour all his operas, none more than the massive Die Frau ohne Schatten. Electra has a sister, Chrysotomis, who in the second scene of the opera tries in vain to convince Electra to forget the past. Chrysotomis wants to be a mother, another theme that will come back in later Strauss and Hofmannsthal operas. But she can't lead a normal life as the household remains frozen in time by the spectre of Agamemnon's murder. Chrysotomis has overheard their mother's plans to lock up Electra, and she hopes the news of this will galvanize her sister into leaving. Her hope is vain. The fact that Electra has no interest in becoming a mother is, in the vocabulary of early 20th century Vienna, a blatant signal that she has abandoned her humanity. Metaphorically, she is a rotting corpse, feasting daily on her obsession for revenge. That no one has locked up Electra is as surprising to the gossipy maids as it is to us, the audience. She's clearly mad. But hers is not the only clinical behaviour. Her mother, Clytemnestra, is equally haunted by what she has done. She can't sleep and is tormented by nightmares. Electra assures her mother that the problem can be solved if they can find the right sacrifice to make to the gods. In the context of Greek drama, this is a perfectly rational proposition. Remember that the Greek gods were worshipped with sacrifices. Throughout the Iliad, both armies continually make devotional sacrifices, pouring out wine and slaughtering animals to appease the different deities. But Electra means something different. When her mother is drawn into the conversation, Electra reveals that the correct sacrifice to atone for the murder of Agamemnon is the queen herself. She will pay for her crime when she's chased around her own house in terror and meets her sticky end begging for her life. Ich höre in den Worten von der Bitte. Elektra's petty triumph is dissipated by secret news that a servant whispers in Clytemnestra's ear. The queen laughs hysterically, leaving Elektra to wonder what has happened. The news is that Elektra's brother Orestes is dead, trampled by his own horse. Chrysotomis announces this to Elektra, who's deeply affected. If justice is to be done on the murderers of her father, it is now up to her. Chrysotomis tries to calm Elektra, but the frenzied woman curses her. So far, I've talked about the shocking story behind Strauss's opera. But as you've heard in the excerpts, the music can be equally violent. A cartoon published after the opera's premiere shows the Greek tragedian Sophocles as an old man. Two young men in 20th century evening dress are beating him. The first, meant to be Hoffmannsthal, has a grip on Sophocles' beard and is gouging out his eyes. The second, Strauss, is kicking the old man and striking him with percussion instruments. The cartoon was not meant as a compliment. The opera was considered by many at the time to be grotesque and fetishistic with a twisted sexual undercurrent, not an exploration of tragedy and obsession, but a celebration of it. It's not hard to see why this criticism was levelled at Hoffmannsthal. The words of his libretto speak, as it were, for themselves. But Strauss was composing music, that most abstract of arts. In what way was he metaphorically beating an old man with a drumstick? The music is not just percussive and dissonant, it's also beautiful. Elektra's music, when we first hear her, is positively seductive in contrast to the harsh music of the household maids. Elektra's obsession is ravishing, and it's this that fueled musical criticism of the piece. But these criticisms were also more specific and technical. To say today that music is dissonant means nothing without further explanation. Bach and Mozart were dissonant. Beethoven was accused of being excessively dissonant. So were Berlioz, Wagner, and just about everyone else who wrote music. Georg Philipp Telemann, Antonio Salieri, and Johann Pachelbel may have been accused of dissonance less than their more gifted peers. But dissonance is the spice that makes music work. What it really means is that these composers twisted the rules. The classical composers evolved a system that was pleasing to the ear, and they codified it into strict compositional rules. Certain combinations of notes were okay, others were not. More importantly, some of the thornier combinations of notes had to be handled in specific ways. Unfortunately, by the time the rules were well enough defined to be written down, they had also become known to audiences. What shocked Bach's audiences might bore Beethoven's. So each generation pushed the boundaries further, breaking the rules and then writing new ones. Strauss was not yet to the point of Arnold Schoenberg, who would claim not only that every note on the keyboard was equal, but also that they all had to be given equal prominence, a sort of musical communism. Classical composition had taught the exact opposite. The note you start on is much more important than the rest. It establishes a scale that brings with it an internal structure. There are 12 different notes from C through B, but do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do picks out and concentrates on 7 of them. Strauss's music does still sound dissonant to us today. I would hope so, since he was still alive a mere 63 years ago. His specific musicological violence in Elektra was to mix different keys, those do, re, mi scales, at the same time. Strauss was a devotee of Wagner, and in his operas, Wagner wrote musical themes for his characters and ideas, so-called leitmotifs. Strauss did the same thing. In Elektra, he followed Wagner in one other way. The prelude to Wagner's Tristan und Isolde is built around a single dissonant combination of notes that came to be known forever after as the Tristan chord. Elektra too has her own chord, not surprisingly called the Elektra chord. And it is built out of two groupings of three notes taken from entirely different scales. Metaphorically, Hofmannsthal was taking a stick to Sophocles, but Strauss was taking a stick to the generations of opera composers who had gone before. The violence of the Elektra story is mirrored in a violent rewriting of the musical expectations of Strauss's day. We'd gotten to the point in the story where Elektra has learnt that her brother is dead. Except, in a dramatic reversal, he isn't. Elektra is digging in the ground to recover the axe that killed her father. She means to use it herself on her mother. But she's interrupted by a mysterious man who claims to be a friend of Orestes. He is, of course, Orestes himself. He spread the false rumour of his own death to disguise his intentions and has returned to avenge his father. At first, brother and sister don't recognise each other, but when they do, Elektra is ecstatic. She's glad to see her brother alive, but she also feels that killing mother is a man's job. Orestes disappears into the house. One of the principles of Greek tragedy was that actual violence, as opposed to bloodthirsty poeticizing, takes place offstage. And Hofmannsthal, who was a student of Greek drama, follows his teachers. As Elektra listens in ecstasy, Orestes kills not only his mother and her lover, but all of their followers as well. In the various Greek dramas about Elektra, she usually survives the horrors of the fall of the House of Atreus. It is Orestes who becomes the central figure of the so-called Orestia, chased by his own conscience in the form of three attendants to the gods, the Furies. The problem with vendetta justice, we learn, is that it never ends. One of Clytemnestra's reasons for killing Agamemnon in the first place is that on his way to the Trojan War, he made a human sacrifice of their daughter Iphigenia. She kills Agamemnon, Orestes kills her, so now someone has to kill Orestes. It doesn't make for an orderly society. Aeschylus ends his Oresteia trilogy with Orestes being tried and acquitted in a divine court of law. His lawyer is Athena, so perhaps the acquittal should not be a surprise. Henceforth, justice will be conducted under a rule of law, not by personal revenge. Electra may survive in Greek drama, but we learned in the opera's opening scene that she is already, metaphorically, a corpse. She has sacrificed her own life to revenge. The opera ends with an ecstatic dance in which she celebrates the bloody justice that has been carried out and promptly drops dead.